Exeter University, and René Vink, author of a newly published book on Wagner and Tolkien. René, Tolkien said, both rings are round, but there the resemblances end. Is that actually true?
In fact, there are quite a few resemblances between his story and Wagner's intrigue. There is this ring, of course. That's the hugest resemblance of all. It's not just any ring. It's a ring of power. Wagner's ring was made by Alberich to dominate the world, and Tolkien's ring was made by Sauron with the same purpose. And then you have this immortality issue. You have reforged swords. You have Irin, who becomes mortal. You have the motif of the ring having to return.
So yeah. We have a very long list of resemblances. Yeah. Has Tolkien been reading Wagner, or have they both been reading something else?
Well, Tolkien did read Wagner, actually. He's listening to Wagner, he's reading Wagner, he's reading Shakespeare, and he's then being inspired to do something different because he sort of feels, well, they're onto something, but they haven't quite got it right. And the thing that Tolkien, I think, disliked about Wagner was that he wasn't a scholar, that he was actually dealing with this material at second hand, whereas Tolkien wanted to extricate the story through scholarship rather than through a simple leap of imagination.
Who was Tolkien? What did he do? What was he like?
He was a professor at Oxford University. He began his career actually in the Lancashire Fusiliers, fighting in the First World War. After the war, he worked on the Oxford English Dictionary, looking at the history and the definitions of words. And that really developed his interest in philology, which is looking at words. I mean, Tolkien treated them as artefacts, as if they were these sort of archaeological survivals, and could teach you about the attitudes, the values of earlier society. He leaves the Oxford English Dictionary, works in Leeds for a few years, then goes back to Oxford as a Rawlinson and Bosworth Professor of Anglo-Saxon, and is then made Professor of Language and Literature.
And does he ever leave again?
No. It's for somebody who has this extraordinary, I mean, almost limitless and capacious imagination, he's quite happy working in Oxford. He works very hard in Oxford. He's a very esteemed teacher. He's happily married. He has four children. He barely leaves the country.
Never changes pub.
Well, he moves from the Eagle and Child to the Lamb and Flag.
Oh, well, there we go.
Across St Giles. So it's only over the road.
The Eagle and Child, Bird and Baby.
Bird and Baby is how it
goes. There's actually a plaque inside the pub which mentioned him and C.S. Lewis and others.
Charles Williams. There appears to be no scandal. It's a very quiet, gentle, peaceful life, and yet one in which imaginatively is absolutely teeming with these alternative worlds.
Why did he go to the Norse myths in the first place?
He was a professor of Old Norse, among other things, so yeah, well, it's rather natural he would go to the Norse myths. I'm not sure about Wagner not being a scholar, or a philologist, to be precise. Well, he wasn't, that's true, but he knew more about it than he's usually given credit for. He read a great deal about philology. One of his friends, at least one of his friends, was a translator of the Icelandic Eddas. And you see in his text that he was quite aware of what he was doing. So I'm not sure the main reason why Tolkien rejected Wagner was that he was a fake philologist, an amateur. I think there was a very huge problem after World War II with Wagner, in that he was Hitler's favorite composer. If he did reject Wagner, this was a very important reason, I think.
Yeah, he had an absolute love of that Germanic tradition, of the northern spirit, of northern courage. His real love is in Middle English, it's in Old English, it's in Old Norse, and Gothic. There's a story about him as well, reciting the Lord's Prayer into a tape recorder in Gothic to dispel any demons that might be lurking therein.
But that's, I mean, they're both nationalistic in some sense, aren't they?
The word nationalism, I think, is perhaps the wrong word to use. Mm-hmm. He's certainly patriotic with a small p. He says that he wants to produce a mythology that he's going to dedicate to England, because he feels that England has lost its mythology. Wales has a Mabinogion, the Finnish have the Kalevala, and so forth. He wants to offer something that can be dedicated to England. He's very fond of his English background. He's born in Bloemfontein, of course, but then he moved over in early childhood. He's very keen to call himself English and not British, so he sort of does see that as part of his sort of constituent identity. And there is this great sense of loss, I think, that there aren't the epics, the poems, the sagas that the English should have. They've actually disappeared. This is one of the reasons, I think, for why he's trying to sort of fill in those gaps to try to recreate that. Mm-hmm. He's also, of course, somebody who fought in the First World War. He was at the Battle of the Somme as the signallers officer for the Lancashire Fusiliers.
I think he kept writing about his experience in World War I all his life.
Yeah,
Disguised it as something else, but it occupied him for the rest of his life.
It is something you see it very clearly, I think, in the Dead Marshes sequence when Frodo and Sam are being led by Gollum across this terrible ancient battlefield, and they sort of look into the marshes and they see these cadaverous faces staring back at them. And Tolkien did admit, in a rare moment of exposure, that this was influenced by his time at the front.
Do you think that if we hadn't got his fiction writing, we would have had any idea of what was going on inside his head?
After the war, I mean, he was invalided out with trench fever. He then said that he'd lost all of his close friends in the conflict. So this made a huge impact on him. That's when he starts writing his own mythology. And in fact, when we get to The Lord of the Rings, he's writing that through the Second World War, when two of his sons are both serving. There is a tirade in one of his letters against that ruddy little man Hitler, who has appropriated this northern spirit, this sort of great tradition, and has put it to bad uses. And you can certainly see that sort of, in a sense, sort of Tolkien's belief that national myth was significant is being proven, but in completely the wrong way, in Nazi Germany.
He was living through a great time of change, wasn't he? I mean, as Wagner had before him. What do you think it was about these times of change that brought this response?
I'm not sure if Tolkien wouldn't have written things anyway. In any time that had forgotten the things he loved, the Norse mythology, the Beowulf, he could have written it 100 years earlier, I think. He would have reacted against the Industrial Revolution as well.
Yes, I think that's right. But I can certainly see that in his love of the environment, although even that, I think, is complicated by the fact that everybody remembers the Ents and they're these sort of wonderful tree creatures in The Lord of the Rings. However, there's also the Old Forest, which is on the edge of the Shire, which is a pretty terrifying place. It's the first real danger that the hobbits come into is actually from Old Man Willow.
From my childhood reading, I have nightmares about Old Man Willow. I have nightmares about the Barrow Wight and the creeping hand that comes towards them in the dark. I have nightmares about all the creatures in Tolkien's world who are not directly part of Sauron's moral universe, not directly part of the battle between good and evil that's going on in the present of the Lord of the Rings and of the Hobbit before it. Where does this come from?
That's why I think it's such a rich creation, because it's not a single-minded quest. You do get this very strong sense that there's all sorts of other issues going on, things happening outside the main narrative. That sort of stuff, I think, is very much coming from Old English. To get hold and remind the readers of this mysterious, frightening English folklore that still lurks in the shadows of memory.
Is there an equivalent in Wagner, René? Or is the Wagnerian world a complete world without those kind of sinister loose ends?
I think that Wagner was less aware or less convinced of the hostile side of nature. He strongly opposes the natural world with the world of law and compulsion. And he believes that if you can only do away with man-made regulations, if you can go to nature, everything will be all right. And I think he's more naive in this than Tolkien, who from the beginning is aware of the fact that, as he says, I think in his Beowulf lecture, that we are mortals hemmed in a hostile world.
That there are still connections, I think, with the works of something like George Orwell. And it's very, I think, significant to read Tolkien in that context of the 1930s and also the immediate post-war period. We're all familiar with 1984 and Big Brother. Well, what's the Eye of Sauron, this sort of great sort of surveillance operation, except for a fantasy version of the telescreen? In the same way, I think you can see one of the final chapters of The Lord of the Rings, The Scouring of the Shire, is about petty fascism with the same sort that you get at the end of Animal Farm.
Because Wagner was a political animal all his life, wasn't he? And a very radical one, somebody who got in trouble for left-wing views.
He was rather an anarchist at first. The Dresden Uprising of 1848... although it's not entirely certain that he actually took up arms, but he aided the people who did. He was compelled to flee because he was almost being arrested by the authorities, and then he got banished for years from Germany. His ring has often been seen as anti-capitalist. For instance, George Bernard Shaw interpreted it that way. Later he got more entangled with the establishment, especially after his connections with King Ludwig of Bavaria, who, of course, was the establishment of his time.
Funny enough, Tolkien described himself as an anarchist in a letter. I think that's partly tongue-in-cheek, yes, because he's obviously a conservative in many ways.
One of the things that they clearly have in common is a sense of a natural order that can be broken, absolutely broken, part of the jeopardy that the ring cycle works under and that the Lord of the Rings works under is the sense that if it breaks, moral collapse will be echoed in what we would now call ecological collapse.
Wagner's ring starts with what you could call an ecological disaster. The pure Rheingold is stolen by the arch-capitalist Alberich, who forges this ring, dominates the world, amasses a huge capital and wants to buy the entire world. The purpose of the ring cycle is that this should be undone, that the natural order should be re-established.
Why then do we have to have imagined worlds? The disaster in the Shire at the end of Lord of the Rings, or the potential, the averted disaster, is rather literal, after all. Why didn't that satisfy Tolkien's imagination?
First of all, it's the experience of the Great War again. Now, this isn't fantasy as a form of escapism. It's simply a way of trying to address what to Tolkien was this impossible clash between this spirit, this northern spirit of courage. And you see it as well in the Battle of Maldon, for example, when, you know, you're fighting against impossible odds, but that's what you do, even though you know that you're going to be defeated. The conflict between that and the terrible reality of the slaughter in the trenches. And the two don't really match up. So what happens in a work like The Lord of the Rings is you do get, I mean, hobbits who are, you know, really sort of everyday folk, and particularly the character of Sam, you know, who is very much that Great War English soldier, the sort of Batman of one of the officers, just trying to muddle through, just trying to sort of get by against these titanic forces. And so it actually becomes a way of trying to incorporate what little seeds of courage you can. That's, I think, why sort of Tolkien doesn't have a Siegfried character, for example, in The Lord of the Rings. It's about failure. It's about doubt. Let's not forget that Frodo fails in his sort of anti-quest, which is to destroy the ring, although the ring is ultimately destroyed. And the whole of The Lord of the Rings is about a retreat away from myth. It's about the end of a myth and enchantment, and accepting history is going to replace that. And history may well be progressive, but it doesn't have any of the magic.
Yeah, you see a gradual move from myth to history in Tolkien's entire work.
Yeah.
You start with this big myth in the Silmarillion with the gods and the elves and great issues, and then it ends with this Scouring of the Shire, which is very close to home, which could have been among ourselves. So you see these great things that lead to something that happens in your own backyard that demands your personal resistance against the evil you see around you.
Do you think then that Tolkien is in some sense bringing Wagner home? Because I don't see very much sign of any Batmen, any Sams in Wagner.
No, there aren't. In Wagner's ring, everything is big, from the beginning to the end. You could say there aren't any normal people, but on the other hand, you have a god who is very human. So,
I think that it's the 20th century dilemma, is how do you have those make those moral decisions when you are dealing with that sort of everyday domesticity? And that there is no apocalypse at the end of Tolkien. There's no end of the world. What there is Sam saying, well, I'm back.
It's in a way, it's an apocalypse for magic, for enchantment, for everything larger than life.
When we talk about it now, it sounds to me as though at the beginning of the 21st century, I should really be going home and getting out my Lord of the Rings again and giving up on the Wagnerian ring cycle. Why should it still be speaking to me if I have been through the experiences of the 20th century, which tell me that I need to know about how to engage with moral decision in the quotidian and not just in the grand deeds of gods and demigods?
That, in the first place, I'd say because it's wonderful music and that it remains that way. When it comes to the story, I'd say that it is still relevant, if only because we have in our time the same issues about money and power that he wrote about in the 19th century.
It may be that Tolkien is slightly closer to us in the 21st century. But of course, I mean, what he's doing, he's wanting to reach back way earlier than the 19th century into what we'd now call the Dark Ages, or even sort of earlier than that into this mythological realm. It doesn't make it irrelevant just because it doesn't have aeroplanes or iPads in it or anything like that.
It's about making the right decisions. Frodo has to make this decision to take the ring to the fire. He is not appointed. He has to make the decision himself. And in the ring, you see Wotan having to make the same decision, not interfering, not honouring his contracts, of doing what is right.
Could hobbits walk in Wagner's world?
I doubt it. I think they would. In the first place, they are, in a way, a bit of comic relief. And there is no comic relief in Wagner, not really. He has a few scenes which are meant comically, but they don't just work that way. And secondly, everyone in Wagner's story is larger than life, and he has no real representative of the human race on the stage. The person who comes closest is Wotan, but he's also too big for us. We are more spectators when we go to Wagner's operas. Whereas in Tolkien, we are represented personally in Tolkien's works.
And Nick, could Wotan walk in Tolkien's world?
No, I don't think so. I think possibly in the First Age, which is the period covered by the posthumously published Silmarillion. And I think that the Wagnerian figures would be more at home in that world. And that's just the great mythic structure that lies behind the Lord of the Rings. It even lies behind the Hobbit. It's referred to in the Hobbit as well, in the Sword of Gondolin and so forth. So I think that as a remote background, yes, but as Rennie, I think, quite rightly says, it's through the hobbits that we're actually connected. They provide our entrance and exit to Middle-earth, and they guide us through it. And they're the ones who, in fact, have ears for all the other characters. They do introduce us to the whole spectrum of sort of opinion that runs from good and evil and at all points in between.
In fact, we as humans, we only come in at the end of Wagner's Ring, at the end of Götterdämmerung, when humans are left to their own devices and they can decide not to make the mistakes that the gods have made. But before that, humans are spectators.
We're going to imagine something here. Imagine we are in Oxford in that pub and Wagner is produced from the shades and Tolkien. What would they have talked about over a pint?
Tolkien would have asked why Guthrum is played down so much. Because in the sources and in Tolkien's own new lay of Guthrum, and is also in his new lay of the Volsungs, he's very interested in this figure as a strong female figure within this particular saga. And because of the artistic decisions that Wagner makes, she's actually sort of downplayed significantly. And I think that Tolkien, despite what some critics say, does present powerful women characters throughout his work. And, you know, it's interesting that he should have chosen to write about Guthrum as well.
This would suggest that Wagner did not have any powerful female characters. And, of course, he has. His Brunhilde is a very powerful character. And he might have asked Tolkien why he was being negative about Brunhilde. So,
of course, Tolkien had a fascination with music himself. The Arne Lindeley, which begins the Silmarillion, is this great symphonic creation of the world, imagined as music, and songs and ballads run through the Lord of the Rings. In fact, it's possible that, you know, he's the most read poet of the 20th century, precisely because of the number of rhymes that there are in the Lord of the Rings. And some of them were actually set to music, and in fact, there's recordings of him singing them as well. So I mean, he did sort of have that interest in musical settings, but it turns out to be at a much sort of lower level, if you like. It's to do with popular culture of the Shire rather than necessarily the sort of orchestral work of the 19th century.
So we have to envisage Tolkien and Wagner sitting over their imagined pints, talking about women and popular versus classical music.
Well, women certainly. Yes.
I think that would be provide enough for a good evening's drinking.
Susan Hitch was talking to René Vink, author of a new study of Wagner and Tolkien, and Nick Groom, professor of English at Bristol University. Now, these performances of Wagner's Ring are some feat for all of the musicians on the stage down there beneath me here at the Royal Albert Hall, but it's almost as joyously challenging an experience for those prommers standing for the aeons of the Ring cycle. The arena here at the Albert Hall has been absolutely jam-packed every night. Georgia Mann went out this afternoon to catch up with some of the prommers.
They know no fear. Heat and physical exertion does not faze them. I'm not talking about a Wagnerian hero, oh no. I'm talking about Al, Sean and Helen. Yes, there they are, who we last spoke to. Good afternoon. Who we last spoke to when they were queuing patiently for Die Walküre on Tuesday night. They're back. They could not stay away and they still don't have all their clothes on. Al, how was Die Walküre? You were absolutely explosively looking forward to it.
Incredible. This production is doing things for me that have never been done for me by any opera or any Wagnerian opera.
Which is amazing considering this isn't staged.
Yeah.
Why
yeah.
so? Why?
You can't say whether it's what's happening or whether what's going on in your own life. It's like Shakespeare, you know. Every time you come back to these things, they're so vast and so dense that it seems to tell you something more that you didn't see, that you can work out something new. For me, this time specifically, it's Votan. I think in the way that they're doing it with the different actors is uncommonly wonderful. Ian Paterson in the first night as, you know, a regal politician who can't show anything. In the second, with Bryn, when you get inside Valhalla and inside the character and you see the most wonderful portrayal of masculinity as something that is performative in its own raging attempt to try and recapture youth and recapture that wonderful joy of life of being a kid and dancing to Bruce Springsteen and kissing girls. That's all Votan wants.
That's exactly what Votan
would
have been
doing.
That's
what he wants.
There is no doubt.
But he can't. He's an adult. He's got his spear. And it's obviously much more complicated than that.
There is so much to every character. But I have to ask, Bryn, you couldn't wait to see him last time, Sean.
Yeah,
and you,
I know.
Helen.
I'm slightly embarrassed, but the nation knows that.
Well, I mean, how did he measure up to your expectations? Because had seen Bryn do Votan at the Royal Opera House.
That's right.
How was he for you?
Yeah, amazing. Absolutely brilliant. I mean, to be that close as well is such a privilege and incredible. You know, we can only do that here, I suppose, for a fiver. And he was amazing, really special.
And it isn't in any way an issue for you that there isn't continuity in that respect?
No, I think that's what's so special about this Ring cycle is, you know, it's not a run, it's not a production, it's here and now, Baron Boehm, all these different performers doing it in their own way, and then you get such a complete overview of what the Ring is trying to do on so many different levels.
Baron Boehm's carrying you through, you just need the story.
Well, Helen, I have to say, you were an operatic virgin to some extent.
Yes.
I was very pleased to hear that you listened to it on Radio 3, of course. We all do. However, you hadn't before Tuesday's Walküre actually come and seen one. So how was the experience for you?
It was phenomenal. Of all the gigs I've been to, that it's the one that's spoken to me the most, been the most powerful and enjoyable. There's like this sort of frisson in the crowd, and when it began, everyone was just firing on all cylinders. Oh my God, we're only paying £5, and yet we're so close to that stage. Every nuance, every emotion, the acting of all those performers was superb, and you just got so involved with the story and the characters. I was nearly in tears by the end of Act One.
This is what we like to
hear.
Fabulous. Guys, I'm going to leave you to your queuing, of which there is still several more hours, and we will catch up with you again for the great climactic moment, which we are heading towards on the weekend at Götterdämmerung. Thank you very much. Thanks, guys. Moving along the queue now, a little bit further back towards the Royal College of Music, I've spied a group of gentlemen. Hello, chaps, I'm from Radio 3. Do you mind if I ask you a little bit about your Wagner and queuing experience? First of all, where have you all come up from today?
Brighton.
Yes.
Do you, sir? Manchester?
Haywards Heath via Gloucestershire.
Wow. So we have some true wanderers here, appropriately, given that it's Siegfried that you've come up for. Have you been to the previous two instalments?
Oh, yes. Yes.
And what, for you, have been the sort of standout moments so far?
The standout moments for me were certainly, I think, Bryn Terfel's portrayal of Votan, which was absolutely incredible.
Is that the same for you, gents?
Yep, definitely Bryn Terfel, yes.
And how about the heat? There's no denying it's warm right now.
You just put up with it, really. You forget that once you're in there and the music starts, and you just forget the heat, really.
I'm making my way down an increasingly growing queue to two ladies. Hello, ladies. We're from Radio 3. I've just come to find out how long you've been waiting in the Wagner queue.
Good number of hours. Yes.
A good number.
Yeah, but it was worth it.
Okay.
Yeah, we're hoping that we'll get tickets, and we are fairly confident that we will, because I think they said there's at least 100 tickets available.
I'd say, looking at the queue right now, you've got a good chance. And yes. Have you already been to the previous two of our ringside
operas? No. In fact, I'm just visiting London for the weekend, and just realised that this was possible to do, so it's made my day.
Tell us where you're from, sir.
Another Brightonian, standing here in the almost sweltering sun.
How did the Ring Cycle first come into your life, sir? Where did you first discover this music?
That's an interesting question. My father was, he came over to this country as a German Jewish refugee in the 1930s. He always loved Wagner, despite his association with anti-Semitism and the way that the Nazis exploited that. And I was rather pulled two ways, because my mother couldn't stand Wagner, and so Wagner for me had the attraction of forbidden fruit. But as I came to hear more and more of his work, my knowledge of it and love for it became, well, acquired a much more secure basis.
Do you think Wagner is something that you do come to perhaps as you mature, as you get older, because it can...
Well certainly you discover more and more in it. For me, part of the huge fascination of his operas or music dramas is that you can sit up far into the night discussing what they mean without ever reaching any one single conclusion.
Which I think might have been what Wagner was intending, perhaps. Mm. Thank you very much. I hope you enjoy it this evening.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Georgia Mann, who'll be back with her promos on Sunday for Goethe Dämmerung. Now, we've had about 25 minutes or so between the second and third acts of Siegfried here at the Royal Albert Hall, but that's nothing compared to how long Wagner took off between them. There's a 12-year compositional gap before he returned to Siegfried's journey to Brunhilde. And a lot changed in that time between 1857 and 1869, not least the composition of Tristan und Isolde, which you can hear tomorrow night here at the Proms in the Royal Albert Hall, and Die Meistersinger von Nuremberg, which you can't. I asked Daniel Barenboim how he thinks of the difference in development between the music of the forest in Act 2 to the bleak mountaintop of Act 3.
It is basically the development of chromaticism. See, because when you have chromaticism, you get all these chords that create a dissonance, and you have many possibilities of resolving the dissonance, which you don't have so many when you have chromaticism. In other words, when you say, not in music, outside of music, about a certain person, oh, he's so ambiguous. This is almost critical, isn't it? Like, he doesn't know what he wants. But the chromaticism creates a positive ambiguity in the music, because it is so much tension when you get this dissonant chords, like at the beginning of Tristan already, and they can be resolved in so many ways. And therefore, it creates further expectation. I think he knew that. It's not only that he wrote these chords and then somehow resolved them, but he knew, and here I'm going to really create a sense of suspense, like Hitchcock a little bit.
Daniel Barenboim, Wagner, the master of suspense. Ripple of applause here for the players of the Staatskapelle Berlin as they come on stage at the Royal Albert Hall. So we're going to hear now the final act of Siegfried here at the Proms. After a thrilling, churning and chromatic prelude, the wanderer, Votan, calls desperately for Erda. She and Votan have had 9 daughters together, including Brunhilde. Erda is the fount of all wisdom, who saved Votan from himself at the end of Das Rheingold. Can she now again rescue the ring, the world and the gods? The answer is no. Votan has sown so much confusion that there's no clear way out. Defiant, Votan resigns himself to the end of the gods and gives fate over to the ever-young and to Brunhilde, who he says will do the deed that will redeem the world. Does he really resign himself? Because he meets Siegfried on his way to the fire and the woman and questions him. But Siegfried only insults this old guy, saying that an old man has always stood in his way and now I've swept him aside. Siegfried doesn't fear Wotan's warnings about the fire or the woman asleep within it. Wotan can't take that lying down. So much for his renunciation of power. He raises his spear and threatens Siegfried, who is, after all, his grandson. Exasperated, Siegfried strikes out at Wotan and shatters Wotan's spear. Wotan, his power extinguished, leaves. And that's the last that we'll see of him in the Ring Cycle. The final scene of Siegfried is the most optimistic and joy-filled in the whole cycle. Siegfried finds, kisses, and wakes Brunhilde after an initial confusion, it has to be said, as to the gender of the person in the armor suit within the Ring of Fire. Das ist kein Mann, Siegfried says. That isn't a bloke. And their radiant, sublime duet between Siegfried and Brunhilde closes the opera. They renounce the gods and embrace as people, as human beings, in passionate love. Love that's fully human because they both face their fears and doubts as well as their joys. If the gods must die, the world surely will be safe in the hands of Siegfried, Brunhilde and their love. Well, maybe. But let's leave that for Sunday. The singers you'll hear in the third act of Wagner's Siegfried here at the Proms. Terje Stensvold is the Wanderer, Wotan. Anna Larsson sings Erde again the role she sang in Das Rheingold back on Monday. Lance Ryan is Siegfried, and Nina Stemmer is once again Brunhilde, picking up from where she was left on top of that fiery mountainside at the end of Die Walküre on Tuesday night. One of the stories is emerging for me, listening to the whole Ring Cycle here, is Daniel Barenboim's relationship with Wagner tradition. You know, this is a conductor who was introduced to Wilhelm Furtwängler at the age of 11, played the piano for Furtwängler when Daniel Barenboim was 11. Furtwängler pronounced him a phenomenon. Now, Barenboim has got a very conscious sense of what other conductors have done before him, but the one he admires above all is Wilhelm Furtwängler, not because he's trying to replicate the way that Furtwängler conducted The Ring, two famous recordings from Rome and La Scala in 1950 and 1953, but rather you get the sense that with Barenboim, he's shaping everything in the moment all the time. The reason he admires Furtwängler is because you have a white heat of intensity and strange alchemy where the moment of recreation, of performance, feels like a moment of creation. That's what this Ring experience feels like to me. Barenboim with the Staatskapelle Berlin is making this Ring happen, not simply playing it, not simply playing the notes in front of him, but rather creating the Ring for all of us here in the Royal Albert Hall and all of you at home. Startling when you compare the end of the second act with the first notes, the first 2 or 3 minutes or so, the prelude of Act Three that you're going to hear. This really is Wagner looking forward, musically speaking, to the world of Götterdämmerung, but also the world of Parsifal, and even beyond that. It's a piece of music and a way of thinking about music that's denser, richer, more complex than anything that we've heard in The Ring so far. And the journey of this third act is from, I feel, the profoundest depths of despair. We've heard and Susan Hitch's interval feature there about the idea that Wotan is the closest character you have in the Ring Cycle to a fully formed human being. Odd when you think he's leader of the gods. But what you'll hear is desperation from Wotan here. He's realized that his life of contracts and all of those things written on his spear count for absolutely nothing in the face of the confusion that he's created. All of those relationships, all of these children and that he's created and who have had relationships with one another, none of them have been a solution to his essential dilemma, what to do with the ring, what to do with the world. Daniel Barenboim comes on stage, but before he gets to the podium, he brings up Stefan Dohr, Prince of the Horn, who played Siegfried's horn call in Act Two, and he didn't come on for about the end of Act Two, but he wanted to. Barenboim shares a laugh with Stefan Dohr there, and brings the orchestra of the Staatskapelle Berlin to their feet. Already a huge ovation for these players who've already played like heroes so far, and they've still got another act to play. Daniel Barenboim then conducts the Staatskapelle Berlin Act Three of Wagner's Siegfried.
Thank you. Stachelst du einst, der Sorge Stachel in Wotans Bogenes Herz, mit Wotans Wahrvoll feindliche Wände, geht in ein Wissen, das Bangen band seinen Mut. Die Welt, die Körnig.
hab mir gute Kutscher. Ein Vöglein schwatzt vor manches. Kein Mensch doch kann's verstehen, wie man dies nur singt im Sang entnehmen.
Was hilft denn das Blut eines wilden Hunds, dem ihr von Eile blaste? Kaum es lässt Sünde die Zunge mir, da bestand ich dem Vöglein geschnippt.
Als wuchsten im Riesenhoch, mehr reizte ich den Storken hoch und zu. Bestimmen,
ich führte niemand, ein harsches Herr, das Fisch, ich wollte nicht wählen. So schließt mein Kommen, der jeder Stand, ist mir nur mich selbst, seinen Rachen, ich seh mir auf.
Wer fuft das Schwert so scharf und hart, dass der stärkste Feind ihm fiel?
Was weißt mir selbst, dass es nie die Kolte,
in Ostland, in Ostland! Die starken Stücken, daraus das Schwert und ihr geschweißt.
Was weiß ich davon? Ich weiß allein, dass die Stücken mir nicht in sind, schon wie das Schwert bin ich nein!
Shame.
seht ihr mein Zirnen am Ring.
Zurück und alle in dir, dort wo die Pächte brennen, so brennen wir den Ulzig an dir. Wir Thank you. nicht das ferne sinnliche Hassen, denn aller Sinne dich nur ist Liebe. Mit bange Furcht festest du mich, du einzige hast, in der Angst mich erhielt, den Togebunden in mächtigen Banden.
Thank you.
Radiant love, laughing death, the glorious, gorgeous, hopeful end of Wagner's Siegfried. here at the BBC Proms. Daniel Barenboim conducted the Staatskapelle Berlin here at the Royal Albert Hall, bringing the orchestra to their feet and thanking them, talking to them, thanking them before he's going to turn around and take this ovation from the Royal Albert Hall. The singers you heard in Act 3 of Siegfried, Lance Ryan and Nina Stemmer were Siegfried and Brunhilde. Fear and fire faced, conquered and extinguished. Terje Stensvold was Wotan, the Wanderer, and Anna Larsson, the Earth Mother Goddess, Erda. Daniel Barenboim faces his audience at the Royal Albert Hall, the orchestra, the Staatskapelle Berlin, on their feet, and on their feet too in the stalls, not just promming in the arena. In a way, everything that we've heard this week is a sort of gigantic three-part prelude for what we're going to hear on Sunday in Götterdämmerung, the final part of Wagner's Ring cycle, the first time Wagner's Ring has ever been presented in a single season, complete here at the BBC Proms. Daniel Barenboim, smiling himself, pretty radiant with that performance, looks at the six harps assembled on stage just above the horns. Huge horn section, eight horns, who also have to play an instrument of Wagner's own invention pretty well, the Wagner tuba that he commissioned Adolf Sachs to make. Proms Extra tomorrow night at 7:20 on BBC Two. Katie Derham, the first of a series. It's going to be running on Saturday nights throughout the Proms, starting with an interview with Daniel Barenboim and a focus on Wagner at the Proms in this, his centenary year. The singers led by Nina Stemmer, the singers of the whole of Siegfried, including Peter Bronder as Mima, including Johannes Martin Krenzler as Alberich, including Eric Halvorsen and as Fafner, including Renat Maria as the Woodbird. And now, really, everyone in the Royal Albert Hall is on their feet. A standing ovation for that performance of Wagner's Siegfried. But before Sunday's Götterdämmerung, tomorrow night, here at the Royal Albert Hall, Wagner's Tristan und Isolde. Can you believe it? Wagner might have written it between the second and third acts of Siegfried. Well, and tomorrow, astonishingly, you have the chance to hear it too, live on BBC Radio 3 and later in the season on Television 2. Semyon Bishkov conducts the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Huge ovations. The whole cast of singers going to the front of the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall. The cast tomorrow night includes Robert Dean Smith as Tristan and Violetta Urmana as Isolde. Another unmissable chapter in the Proms celebration of Wagner's bicentenary. Well, things seem to be going pretty well for the story of the Ring cycle here, not just in terms of the performance, but in terms of where Siegfried and Brunhilde are and the radiance of their love washing us all here in the hall, and I'm sure you at home too. Will it stay like that? Find out on Sunday in Götterdämmerung. Now, though, it's time to hand you back to Broadcasting House and to James Jolly.
Thanks, Tom, and that was clearly an exhilarated Tom service at the Royal Albert Hall. And don't forget that you can listen again to every prom for 7 days online via the Radio 3 website. And you might like to know that you can also watch the weekly chamber music concert given at Cadogan Hall on Saturday afternoons at the radio website too. From 1 o'clock on Sundays, the previous day's concert will be available. So far you can catch a concert of Renaissance music from Paul van Nevel and his Huelgas Ensemble, including a number of works from Poland, as well as a programme of violin and piano music by Mozart, Ravel and Lutosławski, given by Wilde Frang with pianist Michael Lifts. Now, in a little while, we've music by one of Radio 3's new generation artists, and then at 11 o'clock, we go live to WOMAD.
Join us each night this week at 11 for highlights from the Late Junction stage at the 2013 Latitude Festival. Composer Anna Meredith crosses the boundary between concert hall and festival stage. Multi-instrumentalist Nancy Elizabeth conjures up old English folk traditions, and the electronic duo Walls dig deep into the archives of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. And tonight at 11, we begin a weekend of broadcasts from that leading festival of world music, WOMAD 2013. Latitude and WOMAD 2013, BBC Radio 3 at two of the UK's most diverse music festivals. Join us each night this week.
And that'll be along in just under 50 minutes' time. Now, the British pianist Paul Lewis comes to the Proms on Tuesday to play Mozart's Piano Concerto in C, Kirkel 503. So I thought we'd hear him now in the company of his colleague Stephen Osborne in Music for Four Hands by Schubert. Here's the Rondo in A major, Deutsch 951.
Thank you.
The Rondo in A, Deutsch 951 by Schubert. It was played by Paul Lewis and Stephen Osborne. And you can hear Paul Lewis in Tuesday evening's prom in Mozart's Piano Concerto in C, Kirkel 503. The concert, which features the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Harding, also includes Mozart's Masonic Funeral Music, Schumann's Second Symphony and Sibelius's Seventh. That's Tuesday night's prom here on Radio 3 at 7:30. Now, there's a rich crop of works for piano and orchestra at this year's proms, ranging from Mozart to the present day. We've put them all together in one place for you to listen to when and where you want. Find them online at bbc.co.uk/proms. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Time now for another programme showcasing some of the best young musical talent around. It's presented by Clemency Burton-Hill.
Welcome to the latest in this series celebrating the talents of our current crop of BBC New Generation artists. Today our focus is on the first ever classical guitarist to grace the scheme, 21-year-old Sean Schieber, who gets us underway with this flamenco-inflected sliver of Spanish folk life from Albéniz. Thank you. Athduriath by Albanith, performed by BBC New Generation artist Sean Sheber. Sean's coming to the end of his first year on the NGA scheme. These are exciting times for Sean. He's got his Wigmore Hall debut coming up next spring. He's recently been working in the studio with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, and you may have caught him on Sunday on these NGA programmes performing Defia songs with fellow NGA Clara Moodyth. If not, you can catch up with that on the iPlayer. Well, Sean performs music now from the Catalan composer Federico Mompou, who was much influenced by the French Impressionists. This is his rather meditative Suite Compostellana.
Thank you.
Suite, Compostellana by Federico Monpou, recorded specially for Radio 3 by the first ever guitarist to be selected for our New Generation Artist Scheme, Sean Schieber. It was introduced by Clemency Burton Hill, and she'll be back on Sunday week, the 4th of August, at 5 o'clock with performances by the Signum Quartet and the young New York-based violinist Elena Uriosti. And don't forget that if you want to find out more about the NGA scheme generally, do search Radio 3 New Generation Artists on the Radio 3 website, and you'll find a wealth of material there, including photos, videos and information about all the current artists.
Over on BBC Radio 4.
The principal value is personal liberty. Freedom of dressing as you like, enjoying a glass of beer in a hot summer day.
As Turkey looks east and embraces its Ottoman heritage, Alan Little examines the tension behind the recent unrest.
Erdogan has asserted the supremacy of his own religiously inspired ideology, but it has collided with the voice of an emerging global middle class.
There are lots of people who are really concerned about their personal rights.
Turkey, the new Ottomans, over on BBC Radio 4.